behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben, as always. Scott and I are joined by our super producer, Noel the Hound Dog Brown, and most importantly, you, which makes that Car Stuff.
And I'm wearing my blue suede shoes today, too.
You are wearing your blue suede shoes. Now, that's not an everyday thing for you, right, Scott?
No,
this is a special occasion.
Definitely a special occasion, yeah. You know, church, here, maybe a birthday party.
Sure, or like at a nice JCPenney's.
You know, I don't know. Have you ever seen anybody in blue suede shoes?
I have, but you know I'm from Tennessee, so I have seen
the match.
Right, yeah, I have seen some people wearing some blue suede shoes before. I have yet to see somebody in an all blue suede outfit, though I am sure those exist.
It is likely out there somewhere, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I have been to Graceland as a wee tyke, though I don't remember too much of it.
Oh, really? Okay, you've answered one of my questions I was going to ask you today.
Oh, really?
I was going to ask you if you've ever been there, because I've never ventured over there.
Now, you know, I wonder what it would be like going back as an adult, because, you know, so many things that you do when you're a kid seem entirely different when you're an adult, from watching a film to visiting a theme park or a memorial.
Sure, you couldn't really grasp what you were looking at there. You couldn't understand what you were seeing, probably, if you were really, really young.
Yeah.
I don't know what age you were. I mean, were you like 19?
Yeah, I was 19. I had no idea.
How old do you think you were, just roughly?
Well, gosh, we moved around the age of 8, so I was younger than 8. I was probably maybe 6, 7.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing there is, when you're a kid, if your parents are taking you to museums or places where figures of note used to live, then one of the first things that you notice and remember about the place is that it's just like a house with a bunch of velvet ropes that you can't cross.
Yeah, sure. And you weren't really looking to see just what makes up the jungle room or how opulent the bathroom was there or anything like that, right?
I wasn't walking with a guidebook in hand going, interesting.
Yeah, at 7. Yeah, or whatever age you were. Yeah, right. Okay, I get it. You probably should take another visit back and just and see what you think.
Hey, you should go too while we're on the way. We can make a road trip of it.
Definitely. It seems like it's close enough to us that we could do that, I think.
So by now, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't read the title of this podcast, and why would you spoil the fun? You may think you know what our episode's going to be about today, but I'm not sure. I think this is kind of a left field one for us.
You know what? I'll be honest. You can read the title. There's other stuff going on in this story, as always. It seems like recently, when we've been, you know, kind of researching a topic, digging up some information, it just takes us in so many different directions. And the focus of this one really is whatever became of Elvis Presley's hearse. That's truly, we're going to get to it. I promise you.
Yes.
We have the definitive answer. We know what happened to it.
But we're not going to get to it straight away.
No, not right away, as is our typical routine here, I guess, because we've got a lot of information. I think, where do you want to start with all this? Because I've got a couple of sidebars that I think are pretty interesting.
Yeah.
There's some speculation about what happened that I want to talk about just before we tell you what actually happened to it.
Right. Which, again, we do have the answer.
Yeah, we do have the true answer. And, man, maybe we should just kind of set the scene because, how about this? Let's do something else.
Okay.
Why is this even important? Why are we even talking about this today? Because, who really cares what, you know, hearse Elvis Presley was given his last ride in? I mean, does it really matter? He's in there for just a couple of minutes.
Oh, come on. There's a symbolism to it, Scott.
I guess. Yeah, there is, but think about, there's going to be celebrity hearses all over the place, right? I mean,
that's true.
A chance that, you know, someplace out in Hollywood, California, has got a hearse that has carried countless celebrities in it. I mean, it's likely there. I mean, I would think that it would be like the Burbank area, Hollywood Hills, that area. So what makes this one so special? Why is there so much intrigue around this hearse? And it's got an interesting tale that goes along with it.
Yes. And, we'll start with just a couple dates just to catch everybody up. If for some reason you are not familiar with the person we're talking about, Elvis Presley was born in 1935, a world-famous American singer, actor. You may have heard him at times called the King of Rock and Roll or simply the King. And if you are from the U.S., you definitely know about him. Heck, I would have a hard time believing someone doesn't know about him. However, despite his legendary status, Mr. Presley did pass away in August of 1977, which is kind of where our story today starts.
Yes. We've already talked about Elvis with his car collection.
We did.
Eccentricities, right? Because he really was truly eccentric.
The way he would just buy you a Cadillac.
Well,
that's awesome.
He'd do that. And then he also had other, like he would shoot his cars. And
yeah.
He had quite a temper on him. And,
sure.
He seemed like a fun guy to know, really. I mean, the shenanigans that he and his group would get up to
kind of guy you could have a beer with.
Yeah, exactly right. I forget the name of his group. I'll have to remember that as we talk.
Oh, yeah. It's in our previous episode.
Yeah, shoot. I'll think of it as we're going through here.
Mm-hmm.
But, so we're talking about 1977 and a particular vehicle and why it's kind of something that we want to focus on today, because there's some lore out there about what happened to it. And you wouldn't think that would happen, but people try to, you know, he became such a celebrity.
Yeah.
You know, during his life and then even after his untimely passing in 1977,
mm-hmm.
there were, numerous reported Elvis sightings all the way through present day, really.
Sure.
Well, until recently, I guess, and on islands or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all of his, the memorabilia, everything is so, collectible these days.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so much in 1977. So the car that was used to, to take him to the graveyard
mm-hmm.
really wasn't anything that anybody particularly wanted at the time. It was just another car in the fleet of vehicles that this funeral service offered.
Right.
We're getting scattered here, Ben.
Let's start this way. Let's focus on the car.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so this car at the time was brand new. It was a white 1977 Miller Meteor Landau traditional Cadillac hearse. If you have not heard our earlier episodes that touch on hearses, please do by all means check them out, because there's some fascinating stuff here. So we've got that. We've got the hearse, right? The one hearse that's a Cadillac.
Yeah.
And in
white,
front,
of course.
White, of course, of course. And leading the charge there, or leading the procession rather, is a silver Cadillac limousine. But that's not the only limousine in the entourage, right?
Oh no, this is a huge entourage. And if you haven't seen the Elvis Presley funeral, the film footage of this, you might want to just check out a clip of it, because it's pretty impressive, really. 16 white Cadillac limousines carrying mourners, to the cemetery from the ceremony that happened at Graceland,
mm-hmm.
Down the street, and there are mourners lining the pathway the entire way. We're talking 80,000 people that line the streets. 80,000.
Yep.
I mean, that's unbelievable. This is what a big deal this was. I mean, he was a huge pop star at the time,
mm-hmm.
and I would say that I think in the time just after his death, he even became more popular. I think.
Right.
It seems that way. But again, 80,000 people. That line this final route, I guess, from Graceland to a place called the Forest Hill Cemetery in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And, here's how enormous this ceremony was, I guess. Now they had to remove all those flowers that were at Graceland and bring them with them to the cemetery for the second part of the ceremony. It took 100 vans, 5 hours to move the flowers alone from Graceland to the cemetery. And the CEO of FTD, I forget the guy's name, I think it was Bud Lipinski, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
He flew to Memphis to personally handle what they called the flower problem that was going on there.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. So this is a really big deal. I mean, a lot of people turned out. It was just a well-covered news story at the time.
Right. 80,000 people, that's a larger funeral attendance than some members of royalty have.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, and this is just people that just showed up, and they weren't really invited to the ceremony or anything. It was just people that lined the street as the procession went past them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much that goes on around this whole thing. There's vigils being held at the Graceland.
Sure.
There's, of course, some people are let in to view Elvis's body while he's there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on around the death of Elvis, and it all happens within about 2 or 3 days, again, mid-August of 1977.
Right. That viewing stuff was primarily for celebrities like the Kennedys or James Brown. However, interesting fact here, the police department actually had a code specifically for Elvis sightings, right? They had like a 100 for a homicide, or 200 for something else, and 300 was the code for an Elvis sighting.
Strange, isn't it? Now, they did allow some of the just general populace to come in and see him as well.
Right.
But very limited. I think, people were lined up for so long that, if you were not right there when the gates opened, you probably didn't get in to see them,
mm-hmm.
see him, rather. What a strange thing to do, though. I mean, to be there and then to suddenly have the gates open and you're invited in for a viewing of your
hero,
your
icon.
Hero. That's exactly right. So I think there's one thing, there's a sidebar here that we need to talk about before we get much farther.
Okay.
And maybe two. Tell me which one you want to hear first. There's an interesting story that goes along with the vigil at that evening,
mm-hmm.
the evening of the funeral. There's also a sidebar that has to do with other hearses that have kind of been in the news recently.
Let's do the vigil first and then the other hearses.
Okay, let's do that. So we'll talk about the vigil first. And then we'll go on to some of these other hearses that have kind of been in the news recently. I think it's worthwhile mentioning.
Sure.
All right. So this is kind of a strange bit of history that is often ignored when we're talking about the vigil. And it's a huge gathering of people outside the gates of Graceland the night of the funeral.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Hundreds of people, right?
Yeah,
outside the gates?
I think it was like 300 or so, depending on where you read. The accounts go from like, I think, 250 to 500 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But hundreds of people holding an all-night vigil in front of the, you know, Elvis's mansion there, Graceland. And this is in, this would be August 18th, I believe?
Yeah, August 18th.
August 18th, 1977. And among the mourners were three individuals that we're talking about right now. Alice Hoverter, Juanita Johnson, mm-hmm. and Tammy Bader. And they were aged 19, 19, and 17, respectively.
Okay.
And so they're outside the gate there, and they're talking with some policemen, I think, some local authorities. And they hear some screeching tires behind them, and someone just plows right into the crowd, going like 50 miles per hour, something
Holy
like that.
Holy smokes.
In a 1963 white Ford. Now, this is crazy. The guy was apparently driving south on Elvis Presley Boulevard, but he turned off into some lots on the right, and he turned back around to head north and drove straight into the crowd intentionally. Now, they found out that this guy was drunk eventually because he tried to run from the police about a block later.
Oh, and he got caught.
But he struck two of them, Alice and Juanita, both died on the scene.
Wow.
And Tammy lived. This is a horrible event. She was drugged underneath the car for like a block.
Oh, my god!
But
gosh.
Lived. She's the one who survived.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I'm telling you all this is because this story takes another twist as well.
Hmm.
So she survived this and was in a coma for like 3 weeks and had brain surgery and all kinds of stuff like this happened to her. Bad, bad stuff. When she wakes up from the coma, there's a guy there who, or a guy on the phone rather, and his name is, Donald Beatty.
Donald Beatty.
Now, Donald Beatty is important because the night of that accident, there was a sort of famous photo that was taken. And he is one of the first responders on the scene there. He's helping her out.
Oh,
now,
okay.
It's Tammy laying on the ground. It's not too graphic or anything. Mm-hmm. She's laying there on the ground. And he is, I believe he's touching her knee. And there's another Good Samaritan who's there helping her. But he's closer up by her head. You know, he's talking to her.
Mm-hmm.
And, all right, so, again, she wakes up and Beatty is there. He's on the phone. And I guess she said he just kept calling me, kept pestering me. She said. So I'm reading this news story.
Yeah.
What happened later. And this is where it takes another twist.
Okay.
So she had undergone brain surgery, you know, all this other stuff. And she accepted Beatty's invitation to come and visit her because, you know, he had helped her out at the scene. So she said, of course. But, along with some other family members from Arizona. And she said it was a mistake. Now looking back, I wasn't thinking clearly. The guy, he starts to, almost harass her. Over, you know, at the hospital. Well, she's still at the hospital and afterwards. And, he goes so far as to follow her, from like where she lives. He follows her from city to city. So, you know, the accident happened in, Tennessee. She lived in Arizona, I guess, with family.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe she lived in Missouri, I guess, but she had been in Arizona to stay with family. Then she moved back to, Missouri, her home, and then he went with her. He moved back with her, you know, not with her, but near her.
Uh-huh.
And then she moved to Indiana, and then he moved to Indiana. And
oh, that's scary.
Yeah,
man.
They said, okay, finally the family got together and said, nope, we're buying you a one-way ticket. And they did. They bought this guy a one-way ticket back to Arizona, and they thought that was end of his this twisted romantic pursuit, as they call it, right?
Yeah.
And he was saying things to her like, and the reason that they were upset was not only is he following her and stalking her,
mm-hmm.
He's saying things like, you know, you should marry me. In fact, you really should marry me after what I did for you at the accident scene.
Oh.
He's saying, like, you owe me almost.
You owe me your life.
Yeah, that's kind of what he's saying, right?
So as
she improves, as her condition improves, she realizes that his only role in assisting her at the crime scene was he knelt by her, and I think he put his hand on her knee The other guy was the one who really helped her out. He was just there.
He didn't even save her life.
No, he just happened to be there. So she realized that he didn't necessarily help. And then when he moved back to Arizona, you know, the family gave him this this trip back to Arizona. And I promise we're getting back to Hearst in just a minute. But this is all car related, right?
Right.
Somehow. A guy claiming to be a U.S. Marshal shows up at her home and asks her to sign a petition asking the Arizona governor to pardon Beatty. Now, she doesn't know anything about this. And she says, well, no, I'm not going to sign that. I don't know. For what?
For what? Yeah.
He has been arrested for murder in Arizona, like a 13-year-old girl.
Oh, man.
And so this is a bad guy. And she said, when I think about this now, like the stalking that went on after this whole thing happened, he could have flipped at any minute. He could have, you know, flipped the switch and overpowered me. It could have been over for me as well.
Wow.
So she narrowly escaped it. I think her family did a good job, you know, realizing what was going on there. But this guy was on death row, and he was actually put to death for that murder in Arizona shortly after, you know, he had been involved with Tammy Bader.
Talk about double jeopardy. She was dragged under the car for a block, and then I guess spent the next, years after that? Years. The run from this guy.
I think the murder happened in 84, so that was 7 years later. So she spent about 7 years being harassed by him and then kind of out of touch with him for a long, long time. And, of course, he was in prison on death row.
And not to be flippant, but it does remind me of one of those famous quotes, the police director E. Winslow Chapman at the time of Elvis's funeral and death said, I'm afraid we're going to have people trying to get into the mausoleum tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. There's nothing like an Elvis fan. And he was saying this in the context of multiple strange behaviors by fans of Presley after Presley passed on and was interred, including, you know, people getting drunk and running up shirtless or even nude to try to vault over the gates of Graceland or to break into the tomb. One interesting thing about the sidebar there, with the drunk driver at the funeral is it reminds me of a novel recently published by Stephen King, who I know is not for everybody, but he has some good car-related horror stories, and he had this one that came out recently called Mr. Mercedes, which is more like a detective crime book than it is horror. There's nothing supernatural really in it, as far as I know. But in that story, Mr. Mercedes is the name of a killer who drives through a procession of people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just seems like, and I just mentioned that in case somebody's interested in reading some detective fiction, but.
Or Christine. You could read Christine.
I mean, you could read Christine. There's also From a Buick 8, which is another evil car thing, but, not quite the same. They're different kinds of evil cars. It's just strange how surreal the entire situation was surrounding Elvis's hearse.
And I know that was a little bit off track there, but I found it so interesting that all that was going on. And then as I just found this little bit of, you know, like a side note typically in the story of like what happened that evening. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to this tale that lasts all the way up until, what year was that? 2011, I think.
Yeah.
When he was finally put to death, this guy. So it was like 27 years later. Very, very strange.
So let's talk before we get into the speculation. And again, the definitive answer to the mystery of Elvis's hearse. It's time for a word from our sponsor. And we are back. Let's talk about some of those other celebrity hearses.
Yeah. Now there's other celebrity hearses that have been in the news, and it doesn't happen too often, but this does happen. In 2011, a North Carolina man sold the hearse that was used for Dale Earnhardt Sr.'s funeral. He sold it on Craigslist for $8,800. And I think he said he immediately regretted the decision to get rid of it. The car itself was a 1996 Lincoln Town Car hearse. Had 115,114 miles on the odometer, as they said in this Jalopnik article.
Uh-huh.
And the new owner almost immediately tried to sell it on eBay for $1.5 million. So he buys it for, you know, $8,800. He puts it on eBay immediately for $1.5 million. It did not sell.
There's just no honor.
No, no, it didn't sell. And if it did sell, it didn't sell for $1.5 million. I'll tell you that.
Right.
And then there was also this. Now that was the real deal. That was the one that really was used in that funeral.
Okay.
But there was a fake JFK funeral hearse that was also put on eBay for $1.5 million as well. Another one that failed to sell. But see what I mean here? This is like this is kind of a big business, I guess. If you have something like this, you could make quite a bit of money. Not $1.5 million, because no one's paying that, obviously. But
right.
if you attach a famous name to a vehicle, oftentimes that vehicle will sell for a lot more. I mean, celebrity-owned cars sell for a lot more money than a car of the same make and model.
Absolutely. In better condition.
Yeah, exactly right. And so, you know, this JFK funeral hearse, that you can look up the story about that, you know, the fake and how somebody faked it. Also, you know, this reminded me of the hot rod hearse that we talked about recently, the 1967 Boot Hill Express. You remember that one?
Yeah, which is a cool one.
That was at the Peterson Museum in the basement. And, that one, the reason that one is, maybe famous, I guess. Well, for one, they made it into a hot rod, which is unusual.
Sure.
But it was supposed to have carried a James Gang member to, the Boot Hill Graveyard in Tucson, Arizona. The guy's name was Bob Younger.
Yeah, allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah, that's right. And see, it adds value to it, though. That's why that hearse stands out in people's mind as being somewhat historically significant.
Yeah, and so I'm going to be maybe a little bit abstract here, but one thing that's interesting, at least about society today here in the West where we live, is that the role that once upon a time would have been taken up by, you know, heroes of stories or mythological figures or real life saints, things like that. Mm-hmm. Celebrities occupy all those roles at once now. And just the way that saints would have relics or reliquaries, now celebrities, after they pass away, first off, if they're famous enough, no one wants to admit that they passed away, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't the legend go that, Elvis Presley, Kurt Cobain, who else?
Oh,
Jimi Hendrix, Michael Jackson are all living in a timeshare somewhere.
Sure, yeah, on some island somewhere,
right.
Some remote island.
Right.
Yeah.
But this idea that there's some sort of, non-tangible spiritual importance to things that famous people possessed is kind of crazy, because you start to see the bizarre things that people will do for them, but then also you start to see the bizarre stories that tend to coalesce around these things. I've been thinking this ever since we did our very first episode on a cursed car, which was James Dean's cursed Porsche,
mm-hmm.
right? And whether or not it was an actual curse. Now, just full disclosure for everybody. I don't know about you, Noel, but Scott, I know that you and I aren't really the kind of people who buy into that stuff.
Yeah, not me.
Not me. But it is interesting nonetheless, especially when we start talking about what happened to this hearse, because speculation ran wild.
It did. And, you know, that's before we got the true answer, in which mm-hmm. we're getting to. We're getting to the true answer here in just a minute. But the speculation is kind of interesting to read. And there's some good, you know, opinions here, some good thoughts.
Yeah.
So some of these people that wrote into the site, and I think that I gathered this stuff from a site called Elvis Cadillacs. And it had some comments from people. I don't know if they were gathered from elsewhere. You know, if these were, you know, kind of combined into one article here for the Elvis Cadillac site or not. But some of the comments from the Professional Car Society members were pretty interesting, because these are people that have a deep interest in hearses, and they know a lot about them. They know how many of them are out there, really, which is another factor that we haven't really talked about yet,
right.
But we will get to. Here's an opinion of a member by the name of Bernie DeWinter. And, you know, first of all, Bernie describes the hearse itself, and, you know, that it was, I think we talked about it. It was a 77 millimeter Landau traditional Cadillac hearse.
Yep.
And it was the first of the new downsized Cadillac hearses, the new chassis design. I don't know if the king would like that, being in a smaller caddy.
No, it doesn't sound like him.
Anyway, it's still a big hearse. It's a huge hearse. But his opinion, and this is just a generalization of what he says here. It's a long, long, article, but, the cost was the big factor in this one. He says the hearse itself was not particularly desirable. The chassis change led to a higher load floor, something like 5 or 6 inches higher than the previous design. So that meant that you had to lift the casket and the body
right.
5 or 6 inches higher, which is not easy when you're talking about something that weighs, you know, like 900 pounds combined. It's very, very difficult. Also, the annual demand for Cadillac, because of this change, you know, the annual demand for Cadillac commercial chassis went from something like 2,000 units or more per year to about 900 units per year.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, with all the goofiness of the safety and pollution standards at the time, new American car prices were going up constantly at a time when people were used to moderate consistency from year to year. Oh, this is important. We talk about this a lot.
Yeah.
Now, there's a point in our history where things just skyrocketed, where you know, it didn't seem to keep up with the standard rate of inflation. It just went, it went up.
Yeah.
Up, up, up,
yeah,
up.
Yes,
up. It's
absolutely.
Like cars just continue to get more and more expensive,
right,
because of what they're adding.
Uh-huh.
So he says in, you know, the cost of new car prices in general were going up. It was causing sticker shock with the general public. So you can imagine what that would do to the price of a new hearse. Because it was about $30,000 for one of these at the time.
That's outrageous.
And we're talking about mid-1970s, a $30,000 car. I haven't done the conversion or anything, but that was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
And downsized hearse prices held up far better on the used vehicle market for far longer than the older cars did. So it was a comparatively long time before any downsized hearses finally found their way out of service with the mortuary. So he's saying that the mortuary probably hung on to this thing for a long time. Again, this is speculation about what happened, not really what happened.
Yeah.
And he says other factors to consider would be that in August of 1977, that was the first major meet of the Professional Car Society, and it was held in Cincinnati, Ohio. And prior to that point, hearses at a car show were really kind of unacceptable. I mean, they were there, but they were on the outskirts. They weren't the featured item.
It was seen as kind of, I guess, morbid and undignified.
Yeah, and, you know, again, Elvis memorabilia was not quite as popular back then as it was now. You know, it wasn't as collectible at the time. And, again, 25 grand, if this thing held its value, you know, even years later, people just weren't going to pay it. So cost, it keeps coming back to cost. And there's another one here that mentions, another PCS member. His name is Dennis Goth. And, Dennis mentions that, the Elvis funeral was directed by the Memphis Funeral Home.
Mm-hmm.
And SCI, which stands for Service Corporation International.
The most specific non-vague name ever.
Yeah, I guess. And I can tell you about SCI in just a minute. It's a pretty interesting company.
Yeah.
But as he says, they're a very large consolidator of funeral home properties. They own literally thousands and thousands of funeral homes and cemeteries across the world. And I'll tell you numbers in just a minute, just how big this company is. He says that, he thinks his opinion of what happened here, because before, again, speculation, was that it probably just got lost in the shuffle. There are so many of these cars out there. There's nothing really to distinguish this one from any other hearse in the fleet. And I'll have an argument against that in just a minute. But he says that SCI was notorious in those years for keeping their cars until they fell apart. Now, this is back in the 70s.
Yeah.
He said Memphis Funeral Home is a high-volume firm, and so they have a lot of funerals there. And they have quite a fleet of identical cars. So all these hearses that we're talking about, there may be 10 or 15 or 20 other cars exactly like it. What sets this one apart? He says, I wonder if after a few years anyone even remembered which one of those hearses actually carried Elvis to his grave, or from the hospital, or from the funeral home to Graceland. You know, there's other trips that were made as well. So, you know, they each had their own role, I guess. So that's his idea, is that maybe they... maybe it was just lost in the shuffle.
Right. And maybe it could be a barn find or a junkyard.
Yeah. And you would think, well, how is that possible? How do you lose a hearse in the shuffle? Well, as I said, you know, this company, this SCI, Service Corporation International, was founded in 1962 by a guy named Robert Waltrip.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Houston, right?
Yeah. In Houston, Texas. And it was started with just a single location. He inherited a funeral home from his family. Somewhere in Houston, and he began this SCI, which is the world's largest funeral home and cemetery chain anywhere. I mean, it's enormous. They've somehow remained invisible to the public, even though they're this large. I mean, you probably don't know that you have an SCI funeral home in your city.
But you probably do, because despite the innocuous name, like Service Corporation International, they could be selling anything, right? This company is in almost all 50 states. They're in like 43 states, most of Canada. They're in 8 Canadian provinces and Puerto Rico.
Yeah, parts of Australia, I think, are looking at them as well. And they're trying to branch out into Britain, France, Mexico. Oh, you mentioned Mexico, Hong Kong, Taiwan. This is a big company. I think it's well over $1 billion in annual sales. They handle, in America, in the United States, they handle one in every 11 funerals, which is quite a bit.
Yeah. All to say that it is completely feasible, it's completely plausible that they would have left or lost a single hearse.
Yeah. Now, they have fleets of hearses in different cities.
Right.
And they go from place to place. And you wouldn't know this, you know, if you're not in the business, I guess. And I read about this, you know, in kind of a trade journal, in that they will assume, like, not assume, but I guess, they will appear as if they are part of the small town funeral home, when they go there. They will even go so far as to change the metal plaques that are on the vehicle.
Right.
With, you know, they slide into a slot, and they have row after row of these in different cities. They may have anywhere from, you know, 50 different funeral homes down to just a couple if it's a small town.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that they're able to be on call for anything that happens anywhere at any time. And they have a large staff. It helps out. It's a very efficient way to do it. And again, you don't really know that it's happening when they're there. You know, there's little subtle things that you can look for, like a lapel pin that says SCI. But that's about it. And I think only the top execs wear that. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't know that, you know, those people aren't actually members of that small town funeral home. So all this leads into the idea that, you know, that one hearse that carried Elvis could be lost in the shuffle in a town as big as Memphis, Tennessee. That seems completely plausible.
However, that is not the case. And now that you have heard some of the speculation, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to reveal to you the definitive answer, the actual fate of the 1997 Cadillac hearse that carried Elvis Presley to his grave.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, it was so simple. I mean, this guy wrote in and said, I know exactly what happened because
I was there.
Yeah, I'm the guy. And it's so strange. I don't know exactly where this original post came from because it's been copied several different places. But I found it at a place called findadeath.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it just has the interesting history of a lot of celebrities, you know, the celebrity deaths. And Elvis is one of those, and this story popped up for that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as far as speculation is where it went, this is the real deal. And we are close to this place. This place is just down the road from us, really.
The place
we're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the story, and I'll read it. We can stop anytime to talk if you want. The guy says, my name is Chuck Houston. I'm president of Houston Brothers Incorporated, a funeral car dealer in Marietta, Georgia. And I've been to this place. I've talked about this place in our previous podcast.
Yeah, you have.
The graveyard of hearses in the back, you know, the older ones.
Graveyard of hearses.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. All right, so I'm a funeral car dealer in Marietta, Georgia. Around 1984, I was the last person to drive the hearse that carried Elvis to his grave. Our company, then known as Crane S&S Sales, which my father owned, bought, sold, leased, and traded cars with SCI. So that's the place I just told you about. That's why that was important.
Service Corporation International.
Yeah, so he bought and traded cars with them, and he did so for many years, and he originally sold the new car to SCI. So he knew this car personally. He had association with it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we came back into possession of Elvis's hearse when Memphis Funeral Home updated their rolling stock. And there's a way that they know that in just a moment, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
And people were kind of tracking which hearse was associated with Elvis. I'll tell you how that happens. But he said, we were loaning the hearse to a funeral home in South Florida until their new vehicle was ready for delivery. My father was reluctant to loan the car out. He wanted to hang on to it. It's the only car he ever wanted to keep in his 50 years of business. So there's something special about this one to his father. It was a prized hearse in his collection. He says, the funeral home in Florida was one of the biggest customers and needed a white-on-white loaner desperately. Elvis's hearse happened to be the only white hearse on our lot, and another employee and myself, both of us about 21 at the time, we were going to drop off the car and then spend a few days of spring break in Fort Lauderdale. All right, so he's taking Elvis's hearse to spring break in Fort Lauderdale.
Talking about a road trip. So they leave around, what, 7 p.m.?
Yeah, 7 p.m. They're headed towards Miami on I-75. And around 10 o'clock, it says, we ran out of gas just north of Valdosta, Georgia.
Amateurs.
Yeah, so that's the extreme southern end of Georgia. And he says, what was odd is that a tank of gas in those days would carry you from Marietta, Georgia, to the Live Oak exit in Florida with gas left in the tank. Now, that's a clue right there. That'll tell you. So he says, that was based on the many, many cars my friends and I delivered to the South Florida area in the early 1980s. So they're no strangers to this.
Yeah, and let me be clear that I'm joking when I'm saying amateurs. These guys are by no means amateurs.
Oh, no, not at all. So he says, therefore, we never checked the gas gauge until we were in the vicinity of Live Oak. And, of course, they ran out before they got to Live Oak.
Yeah.
This is all a clue. Here's what's going on. After running out of gas, we walked about 2 miles to the next exit, bought a can and some gas, and started back up the northbound return ramp towards the Elvis hearse.
So after running out of gas, he says, they walked 2 miles to the next exit, and they bought a can and some gasoline. They started back up the northbound return ramp toward Elvis's hearse. But before they got to the highway, a sheriff from Lowndes County stopped them, asked them where they were going, and called them a cab.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so he says, we got her going again and headed for the gas station to fill her up. We're heading south. We're on our way. Just as the way station comes into sight, the engine cuts off. I dropped her into neutral while traveling around 65 miles per hour and turned the ignition. When I did, fire shot out from under the hood on both sides. I eased her to the shoulder next to the way station return ramp, and my friend and I jumped from the hearse as the fire engulfed the front end of the car.
Oh, man. Scary. So there's a fuel leak. There's a huge fuel leak.
That's why it has to be fire shooting out from both under, like, both sides of the hood.
Yeah, and it somehow got in contact with the hot exhaust.
Right.
And caused a fire. So,
and it's over at that moment.
Yeah, it's over. I mean, it's done with at that point. You're right. My friend and I met at the rear of the car as they scrambled out and realized all of our possessions were in the rear of the hearse and the doors were locked. We couldn't get back into the front to retrieve the keys due to the fire having already spread. A truck driver appeared with a fire extinguisher, but it was just too late. Neither of us wanted to get close for the fear that the hearse would blow up. So we stood by and watched as Elvis's hearse went up in flames. A fire truck finally arrived, and all they could save was the rear quarter panels, the rear door, and bumper.
Yeah.
Man. That's something. So a place called Twin Lakes Towing picked the hearse up around 2 o'clock in the morning and carried it to their lot, and the DOT enforcement officer carried us to the local Ramada Inn.
And so we find the rest of the story here. The next morning, the kids call a cab over to this Twin Lakes place. They wait for the wrecker to show up from Marietta. While they're waiting at the towing company, all Chuck can think of is he burned up Elvis's hearse and that his dad is going to kill him.
Oh, no kidding. I mean, this is the only one in his dad's, as he said, his dad's 50 years of service.
That he kept.
That he wanted to keep, that he wanted to hang on to probably for the rest of his life. So now it's gone. And of course, here's a 21-year-old headed down to spring break. Big, big trouble, right? But you know, I mean, clearly it wasn't his fault. Nothing really happened. I mean, it was just a mechanical failure. Mechanical issue.
Yeah. And, again, that goes back to, you know, the allegations that SCI was riding their cars to the ground.
Yep. I guess so. And he says, to kind of wrap this up, he says the remains sat on our back lot, which is on Highway 41, which is also called Cobb Parkway, which is where I went and visited that graveyard of hearses. It sat on the back lot until 1989 when it was finally put through a car crusher and hauled off. My friend and I sat there and watched as it was crushed.
The same guy from the road trip.
Yeah, and he says, other than the VIN, the hearse was identifiable by a number on the lower right-hand side of the rear window. He says, I can't remember that number at the moment right now, but I want to say it was number 7. The number, whatever it was, is visible on some of the footage of Elvis's funeral. This is the one. There's one scene in particular where the hearse is turning left where it's plainly visible. The number sticker was still on the vehicle the day it was crushed. So it matched. They knew it matched
right. When
they had it. They knew that it was the one, and they had also kind of been monitoring this one because clearly his dad had some kind of association with this. He wanted to keep it.
Sure.
He wanted to hang on to it. Again, he says, out of the thousands of hearses that my father has sold over the years, this one was special. We always said that Elvis didn't want his hearse to end up in South Florida.
And so it didn't.
No, that's it. I mean, as plain as that is, I mean, that's what happened. I mean, it was just burned up and that was it. But this is interesting because I don't know if other people along the way have claimed to have owned the hearse that carried Elvis Presley. Because you've got to assume that there's a whole fleet of cars that look identical to that came from the Memphis area from SCI.
Mm-hmm.
And people probably, you know, would say, well, I wonder if this was the one. I wonder if that was the one. But they knew this one. And apparently it was number 7 in the fleet from that specific region, from that specific company. And they had not a tight hold on it, but they knew which one it was. And he somehow arranged to get it back. And then this fate befell it, I guess, in 1984.
So if you are on eBay, friends and neighbors, and so very close to buying what purports to be Elvis Presley's hearse, be warned, be aware, all is not what it seems. This is a very strange episode, too, because I was surprised to find all the detective work that people were doing online to figure out what actually happened to this, because it seems so strange, right? In our modern age where it's super easy to take a picture of anything and we obsessively document everything, it's strange to remember that this is one of the only periods in human history where that ever happened. the human species, if you look at it as a whole, our track record, we're very good at losing stuff. Not just cars. We've lost cities.
Yeah, yeah. Civilizations.
Civilizations. We are very good at losing things. But to borrow a phrase from somewhere else, now more than ever, it is possible to find these lost things, right? So if you have any lost vehicles of yesteryear that you'd like us to look into, or any mysterious disappearances, I'll tell you guys, honestly, we love this stuff.
Yeah, let me tell you, I know we kind of started this podcast off with some non-car stuff, or sort of like tangentially related car stuff.
Sure, sure.
But we got around to the Hearst tale, and along the way, when I was reading about Service Corporation International, I tell you, that place is pretty fascinating. And if we dig into the fleets of vehicles that they own, there might be something there. I mean, who else owns thousands of hearses and thousands of limousines and thousands of Suburbans that are intended to carry bodies and things like that? It's a fascinating industry. And when I was reading about how careful they are about not letting it be known that they're kind of this huge corporation that's
right.
running small town funeral homes, and how careful they are about making sure that the family doesn't know that it's very seamless in the way that it's done.
Sure.
Fascinating.
Because people don't want to associate the death of a loved one with some big corporation, right? People want to have, for lack of a better word, a mom and pop kind of experience, a personal experience.
Individual care.
Yeah. And if you've seen that show, oh, what's it called, Scott? 6 Feet Under on HBO. That show is about a family that runs their own family mortuary and or funeral home. And one of the big antagonistic things is this other company that wants to take over them in all but name. Mm-hmm. And it's strange. It's a story that a lot of people don't know. And I would hazard to say a lot of people would be interested in hearing.
It really is. I mean, I was reading about it, and I had to pull myself away from that because it was fascinating. But I had to do more work on this podcast.
So, I had no idea.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. So if you want to dig into Service Corporation International, at some point we can, with their fleets of vehicles, because I would imagine that upkeep on stuff like that is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Tough to manage all that. And when do you decide when to pull stuff out of rotation?
Right, because if you think about it, the service requirements for a hearse are vastly different. Right. In comparison to something like an ambulance or a trucking fleet.
Yeah,
right.
Each one is a custom vehicle.
Every hearse is a custom vehicle, and they do short stints of service. You're not typically going to see a hearse or a funeral procession driving across the country.
But it's like a work vehicle. I mean, it's a work vehicle.
Yeah, absolutely.
And lots of time idling. So I wonder if there's engine idle considerations to consider. You know what? There's a lot to talk about.
We'll get to it.
Maybe we should.
Let us know what you think. As always, well, maybe enjoyed is not the right word, but we hope this story fascinated you as much as it fascinates us. And tell us what you'd like to hear about in an upcoming episode, especially if you have a missing car you'd like us to try to track down. We'll play detective. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can check out every episode we've ever done at carstuffshow.com. And you can email your ideas to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.